ships on the sea, we built the steam engine.
That is the beautiful voice of Garden Talk regular Lisa Johnson. I am Jill Nadeau, and I certainly can't sing like that. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. It's a prairie edition of Garden Talk today. Neil DeBall is back with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery and recognized internationally as an expert in native plant community ecology. We'll talk about why natives are essential for biodiversity, and we'll also look at burning your prairie, weed control, and as always, take your prairie garden questions. What would you like to know about establishing a prairie garden? Join our conversation by calling 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Neil. How are you?
Hi, Jill. We're doing well under the circumstances.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, we're very glad to have you by phone with us. So let's start off by saying, why are we losing biodiversity in the plant world, Neil?
Well, there are many reasons for that. And this has been going on for a long, long time. It's not an instantaneous occurrence here in the last decade or so. In fact, the prairie is recognized as one of the rarest plant communities in the world because it was systematically plowed up in the 19th century and early 20th century for agriculture. And there's less than one-tenth of 1% of the eastern grass prairie remaining because it was such a valuable commodity due to the innate fertility of the soils, which grew corn and wheat and alfalfa. Basically plowed up. But now, of course, we're seeing that same sort of development occurring around the world. And of course, not just in Brazil and in the Amazon, but in Indonesia and other places, Borneo. And so we're seeing this human pressure is just relentless. And so we're losing all sorts of ecosystems all around the world. So anything that we can do here in our own home can hopefully make at least a little bit of difference in mitigating that sort of impact.
Sure. Now, what problems does that create when we don't have a bigger amount of plants in the world, more diverse?
Oh, boy, how much time do you have? Well, you know, a lot of people call the Amazon the lungs of the planet. But again, that's not the only rainforest. There are rainforests all around in different parts of the world. And we were just in Sri Lanka in January, and there are tremendous rainforests. They're not on the same scale, but very important. And UNESCO World Heritage Sites because they're so diverse. And so you have this diversity that is so important to maintaining the ability for the planet and its inhabitants to adapt to changing conditions. And if you lose that diversity, then what happens to your speciation and adaptability when you have global climate change and changes in rainfall patterns and on and on and on? So the less you have to work with, and the less options you have for evolutionary resilience in a changing world.
So we've got a conflict here between horticulture and ecology. What do you think we can do to kind of, you know, make the fields more even?
Well, let's put that into perspective for people, because a lot of people would not inherently think that there was a conflict between horticulture and ecology.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two different approaches, really two very different approaches to gardening. And the sort of gardening that we do is quasi-revolutionary because historically, gardening is focused around horticulture, where plants are selected specifically for the benefits that they can provide to humans, such as larger grain size, longer blooming flowers, more fragrant, whatever we're looking for, a higher yield, et cetera, to benefit human beings. Whereas in ecology, ecologists generally look at biodiversity and what can we do to foster as much biodiversity and, again, adaptability to a changing world by maintaining gene pools, the genetic diversity inherent within any given species, be it plant or animal. A case in point is the cheetah. The cheetah has a very limited gene pool, and a lot of people are very worried about its survival simply because of inbreeding depression, where it just doesn't have the adaptability to adapt to.
Oh.
So what we do in ecology is our goal is
Neil,
to optimize.
We're having a little problem with your phone. I'm just wondering, are you on a landline or?
I'm on a landline, but we use VoIP, and sometimes it gets interfered with.
Okay. All right. Well, keep going. Right now, it's fine. So sorry
okay,
about that.
If you have a problem, you have my cell phone in case we need to change
okay.
over here.
All right. Sounds good. Okay. Go ahead, Neil.
Okay, so did we miss a certain aspect of this? Was there certain parts that were not clear?
Just the very end, so.
Okay, so in ecology, we're trying to optimize. In ecological gardening and ecological restoration, our attempts are at optimizing genetic diversity. And the way we do that is by growing open pollinated plants rather than selections or hybrids or vegetative reproduction. But if you look at the green industry, if I am a grower of trees or shrubs, and I'm growing open pollinated species, I never know what I'm getting you or selling you because there's so much diversity and variation. For instance, I buy open pollinated trees from a friend of mine who grows them from seed. I have places on my property where I planted the same trees from the same crop on the same day 15 years ago, and the trees were 5 or 6 feet tall when I planted them, and I have some that have not grown an inch and others that are 25, 30 feet tall.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, that's just genetic variety. I got some duds.
Uh-huh. Oh, my gosh. Interesting.
So if I'm a nursery person selling trees, I certainly don't want to sell you a dud. So what has occurred with, at least primarily in the tree industry and in fruits and vegetables, is that we're offering people tried and true, usually vegetatively reproduced plants that we know are going to behave identically the same way every time, and they're going to grow, and they're going to grow at a certain rate, and they're adapted to certain conditions, so you have some reliability, and you don't have customers coming back saying, I want my money back.
Right.
Now, that makes perfect sense.
Right, that means absolutely.
That means that our cities and our communities are being planted to these clones that are essentially identical. And so we have limited diversity in these ecosystems. With a lower diversity, theoretically in ecology, you have lower resiliency and limited ability to adapt to new conditions if there's not a really broad selection of genetic characteristics within each plant. So this is a potential danger in our urban and suburban landscapes, is lack of diversity. So what we do, almost all of our plants are grown from seeds. There are a few that it's very difficult to collect seeds, like phlox, because the seeds are produced in very small quantities and they explode when they're ripe. And you have to be there the day the seed is ripe before it blows up and scatters to the four winds. So those we grew plants from a wide variety of sources, and then we take cuttings off of those and try and maintain as much diversity as possible. So there are a few species where we have to take stem cuttings and a few times root cuttings, but we try to have a reasonably good diverse population from which we chose the original plants.
Sure. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. So the point is that most of our plants are grown from seed, and we put a lot of seeds in each plug when we grow them, and so you will have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plants that go into the pot when we take the plug into the pot and grow it out for what the customer will receive. Hopefully, there's a couple, three plants in there, and so may the best plant win. And sometimes you get more than one plant growing in the landscape.
Sure. Now, what about those new things called nativars? What are those, and is that a good idea to get those or not?
Well, there's a lot of discussion on this. And just so our listeners know, nativars, and a lot of people hate this term, and they're trying to conjure up another term, but nativars, it's a combination between native and cultivar.
Mm-hmm.
And so in horticulture, we make selections of cultivars. These are specific plants with certain characteristics, like a larger flower or blooming longer, different colors, different foliage, etc., things that might be attractive to people. And so people select these, and I fell for this. I had this amazing garden of all these native plant cultivars 20 years ago. And I had people from Holland coming over saying, send this to us. We're making millions of dollars. And I'm thinking, that would be great. But then I thought, well, this isn't really what we're about. And so I didn't pursue it any further. Mm-hmm. I had this great, great garden. But at any rate, the question here is, when you select a plant for certain characteristics that are attractive to human beings, are you losing other ecological values or ecological services for pollinators, birds, etc.? And there are actually studies now that are showing that some of these selected plants have little or no pollen or nectar, mm-hmm. and they're really ecologically not very productive or not very useful. Now, you could potentially breed for plants that produced more nectar or pollen. So it's not inherently negative, but it depends upon what characteristics you're selecting for or breeding for. So if we're just breeding for our own purposes because it looks pretty,
maybe
probably
not
going to do it. Well, yeah, that's all great. It's great in the garden, but this is the revolution.
Mm-hmm.
See, the garden historically has been for people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place of refuge, a place of beauty, a place of solace. And if anything, my goodness, we certainly need gardens right now.
Yes.
But not that anything's really growing yet, but hopefully soon.
Soon. I've seen crocuses.
Yes, my daffodils are coming up.
There you go.
But it's always been homocentric, focused on people. Okay. Now, as we look at a global crisis, not just in pollinators, but in life in general, the garden needs to be for all forms of life. And that is the revolutionary aspect of ecological gardening. That garden is not just for my enjoyment, not just for beauty for me. That garden is for all life. And I want to invite all the birds and the butterflies and the bees and everything I can into my yard, onto my property. And then I am a good citizen of the planet. And that's where the garden has to go.
All right. Well said. We're talking with Neil DeBall. He is the president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. What questions do you have about prairie gardens? We've got a couple of open lines, so give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show, and it's Garden Talk today. I'm Jill Nadeau. Lee Rayburn is our technical director today, and Dean Knetter is our on-air producer, and Neil DeBall is our guest. He, of course, is president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. What questions do you have? We have some open lines, 800-642-1234. And Dean has been trying to get Neil on his cell phone, so we get a little bit better reception, hopefully. And Neil, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. Let's hope we don't get any breakup, because that was just a bit annoying. At least for me. I'm sure it wasn't for you. So
it was fine for me, but it doesn't matter. It was not coming through the other way.
That's right. So I think we're good. You sound nice and loud and clear. So let's go right to the phone. We've got some calls here. First, we have Mo, and he's calling from Oconto. Hi, Mo.
Hi. Hi, Jill. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
And I'd like to just throw a shout-out to John and Nick on the mouth of the Peshtigo River.
Okay.
Here's my question, Neil. I had called in last week and talked about different trees to plant along a riverbank, but they said, actually, Neil is the guy to talk to about plants instead of trees because their roots go down deeper. Any plants that you'd recommend for, like, along a riverbank to help stabilize it?
Sure. Let me ask you a few questions first, Mo. Are you looking at a sunny area or a shady area?
It's going to be sunny.
Okay, good. That's good, because most of your plants that are going to be able to really stabilize the soil do best with sun, because that's usually going to be grasses and sedges. And although many of the sedges grow in shade, most of the grasses require sun. Then the next question is, since you're in Oconto, I assume it's sandy soil. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and is it the area that you're planting, is it sand mixed with a lot of black organic matter, or is it on an upland bank where it's dry sand?
This is going to be right on the riverbank. It's going to probably be a little organic material and sand, not just pure sand.
Okay, and then is this area will be subject to flooding, I presume, is that correct?
It could be.
Okay, and this is a really important question, is if it's flooded, how long would the planted area be underwater? Because that will determine what kind of plants can tolerate that condition.
It won't be underwater except for maybe, because it's going to be right on the bank, and where I am, it doesn't flood unless you get like a ice dam or something like that.
Okay, so you wouldn't expect like a week of flooding of being underwater?
No.
Okay, but the soil is consistently damp, is that correct?
I would think that if we had a long-rooted plant, it would be wet roots.
Okay, well, let me tell you a go-to plant for stabilizing stream banks in sunny situations in almost any kind of soil, sand, clay, organic soil, whatever. It's a prairie grass called prairie cordgrass, Spartina pectinata, okay? And it's a little tricky to get going from seed, so the easiest way and most effective way to establish this is by using transplants. And we would normally put the transplants in about 2 feet on center. It depends on your budget and the area that you're covering, but you don't want to put them any farther apart than 2 feet on center if you can avoid it. And in about a three-year period, they should grow together to form a solid mat. And it's a really impervious solid mat that resists erosion. The roots are not super deep, but in wet soils, oftentimes you don't see really super deep rooting because the moisture prevents, or the high water table prevents the ability of oxygen to go down into the roots. So you won't see super deep rooted plants in a wet soil. On the upland banks, you can use prairie grasses like big blue stem and switchgrass, which have very deep roots, and these are also sod formers and super good at holding soil. But they, big blue stem and switchgrass will tolerate some moist soils, but they don't tolerate extended flooding for more than a week or more. But prairie cordgrass will tolerate a lot of water. And then if you want to enhance the habitat, these species, being grasses, are wind pollinated, so they don't produce pollen or nectar for pollinators, butterflies, et cetera. So you would want to look at some wetland plants that you could possibly include with that. And there are many to choose from, but they're not going to give you the same soil holding capacity that the grasses can give you. There are also sedges that do a great job of holding soil, not quite as good as the prairie cordgrass because most of them do not creep by rhizomes and most of them are clump formers, although there are exceptions. But if you're really looking at solving an erosion problem, probably prairie cordgrass is going to be your best bet in a wet soil.
Okay, prairie cordgrass. Got that. Mo, are you all set?
I got one more quick question along those lines. You said it does. Cordgrass doesn't seed well. Would there be something that would be similar that you could just throw down seed?
Yeah, cordgrass is kind of tricky. It generally has to be seeded in the fall because it has to experience cold, damp conditions in the soil to break dormancy for it to germinate the following spring. It's a little bit picky. It's one of the harder plants for us to grow compared to many of the other prairie plants. So if you're on an upland site or where it's not wet, you can use big blue stem and switchgrass, which can tolerate moisture in damp soils, but not wet soils. So big blue stem and switchgrass are relatively easily started from seed. And I would suggest that you include with that mix some Canada wild rye, because this is a fast-growing, it's a perennial, but it's fast-growing, usually lives 4 to 5 years, fast-growing grass, and it'll give you quick establishment. You may also want to include a nurse crop of oats planted at 3 pounds, now about one to 1.5 pounds per 1,000 square feet if you're seeding in the spring, and that will help give you almost instant soil stabilization because it germinates and grows fast. So you have the three-step process of the oats for immediate soil stabilization, followed by the Canada wild rye, which will germinate in the spring and then grow during the year and stabilize the soil probably by the end of the first growing season. And then starting in the second and third growing season, the big blue stem and switchgrass will really start to take over, and their dense, thick roots will hold that bank.
Great. And thanks for calling back, Mo. Appreciate that. Let's go on to Shane, and he's calling from Eau Claire. Hi, Shane.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great topic of discussion. I would have never even thought about prairie grasses if it were not for one of my closest friends. Growing up, his family dedicated their farm to prairie restoration. So they would grow a bunch of prairie seeds, and then I don't know where they sent them off to, but he ended up going into studying psychology, and his thesis was about, you know, how do you feel about prairies? When you see a prairie, do you think it's as beautiful as looking at a deciduous forest or what have you? And, you know, in reality, when we domesticize everything around us to suit our needs, then it kind of comes lost on people to have something that's so wild and, like you've been talking about, how diverse it is. So I guess my question is it as easy to say a farmer wanted to reconvert their cornfield into a prairie? Is it as easy as getting a mix of seeds and spreading it all over the place? Or I know you're talking about your nursery and how you cultivate plants so that people can start their own prairie gardens, but I wonder what a restoration process would look like for the state if that was something we wanted to tackle. Thank you.
Sure. Well, that's a really good question, Shane. And to establish prairies from seed, it's a very well-developed technology. In fact, the first work was done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum back in the 40s and 50s. Their first establishment was done using transplants in the 30s when they did the original prairie plantings. But then they realized they couldn't do it on a large scale with just transplants, and they actually went out and dug up sod from existing prairies with like bulldozers or with front-end loaders and moved them to the arboretum. Well, that was destructive, and it was very slow going. So then they started working with seeds. So, yes, the ability to establish prairies from seed is well-documented, and people do it all the time. So the first trick is to make sure that you get rid of all the existing vegetation so you do not have competition from weeds, other grasses, et cetera. And if you have a cornfield or a soybean field that is almost always a Roundup-ready corn or Roundup-ready bean field, then you have an almost perfect situation because there are very few, if any, weeds there. So oftentimes you can go straight into those fields if there are no perennial weeds and seed your prairie promptly into a former corn or bean field as long as it was cropped to Roundup Ready corn or beans the previous year. If there are any weeds present, perennial weeds, then you do have to spend the time to control them, and you can do that organically, either mechanically with like tillage, but that requires repeated tillage depending upon the weed that you need to get rid of, or weeds. And you also can use some other crops like buckwheat and winter wheat rotations, where you plant buckwheat in June, cut it down in August, fill it in, and then plant winter wheat in September, and do that for a couple of years if you have weed problems. But if you're working with just a cornfield or bean field that's clean, you can plant the prairie right into that. And it generally takes 3 to 5 years for the prairie to mature. The first year, it's going to look like a weed patch because weeds will appear, even though they don't appear to be any, they will appear. And then the second year, you have some black-eyed citizens and maybe some other biennials that will bloom, and you're getting some hope. And by the third year, usually your perennials start to show up, and you go, wow, that's a miracle. How did that weedy field in the first year turn into this beautiful prairie? And usually by the fourth and fifth year, you even get more species of flowers and grasses appearing as they mature. And properly done, a seeded prairie will outlive the person who did it, who planted it, because it's not a plant, it's a plant community. And that's really the secret to this whole concept of prairie landscaping. You're not planting plants, you're planting a plant community, especially when you're using seeds to develop a larger prairie. And the plants will then reproduce themselves. We can't guarantee you that every species is going to reproduce and flourish there, but many do. And then over the years, with proper management, which is either mowing or burning every other year or so, depending upon the situation, then you have a plant community that will live for decades.
Okay. We are talking with Neil DeBall. He is the president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. Neil, that's pretty much, when you're talking prairie gardening, you have to be patient at the beginning, don't you?
Well, let's make a distinguish between a prairie garden mm-hmm. and a prairie meadow.
Okay.
So a prairie garden is usually when we're installing transplants.
Mm-hmm.
And most transplants, at least the plants that we grow, most of them will bloom the year they're installed if they're planted in April, May, or early June. Because we grow most of our plants the year before, so they're well-developed and ready to go. Some species are slower growing and slower to mature, and they may take 2, 3, or even 4 years to reach full development when you install them as transplants. But the vast majority will bloom in the first year or the second year after you install them. So it's pretty basic. A process is really no different from gardening with perennials in general, although the different plant combinations, placement, et cetera, when you're using a combination of flowers and grasses, is different from traditional perennials. But you're applying the same concepts of color combinations, echoing color echo, and texture, et cetera. So mm-hmm. you can create a phenomenal border garden, English formal garden, a border using all prairie plants, and you wouldn't know that it wasn't something from England.
Okay.
Just by using those principles. When you're establishing a prairie from seed, that is a completely different undertaking because you're usually dealing with much larger areas and longer time frames for maturity of 3 to 5 years instead of 1 to 2 years.
Well, we can take questions on either one. So if you have any, give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's go back to the phones right now. Mark in Dodgeville has a question. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Neil. Good to talk to you again. I'm looking at two principles that seem to conflict with each other. One is local genotype of seeds, and the other is global warming. And I know you know this better than anybody, but for other people listening in, the local genotype is basically an issue of if the genetics have evolved for thousands of years here, those do better in this area. If you bring them in from somewhere else, they may be out of sync, out of time, not pollinate well or whatever. The first is we try to use local genotype seeds. But as we have global warming, we understand that we're going to have warmer and warmer temperatures here. And I'm wondering if seeds from further south of us might be more appropriate to plant because in 5, 10, 20 years, we may have warmer temperatures. In 50 years, we certainly will. What are your thoughts?
You bring up a fascinating topic, and believe me, this is a big topic of discussion among ecologists and gardeners and nursery people. And you could look at this from a variety of different perspectives. Typically, as you pointed out, local ecotype plants are plants that have become, over time, adapted to their growing conditions. And growing conditions are more than just temperatures, rainfall, et cetera. It's also things like day length and extreme temperatures on either end, cold or hot, not necessarily average. So one of the issues, if you bring plants from too far north or too far south, is that their daily sun cycles or their seasons are completely different or are different enough that they don't respond well. For instance, generally speaking, you don't want to move, at least the old rule of thumb is you don't want to move plants more than 2 or 3 degrees latitude north or south. Now, I have planted plants from Wisconsin at my parents' garden in St. Louis, and they did fine, but did they create a reproducing plant community when they were 5 or 6 degrees south of where they were? That I don't have data on. So the plants might grow, but will they actually reproduce and be functional as a plant community? That remains to be seen. So you have a lot of different factors. I am actually planting trees that are not native to Wisconsin from farther south, and they are doing just fine. Many of them have survived two polar vortexes of 2014 and 2018, amazingly. Not all of them. Some of the American chestnuts got killed back to the ground, and some of the Magnolia tripetalus also got killed back to the ground in 2014, but then they resprouted and they're growing again. So who knows? Then you have the question of, if you're bringing plants from more distant, in this case from south to north, are they able to mature and produce viable seeds, and are the progeny from those plants able to live in this environment? So you have a lot of different factors here, not just will the plant grow, but will the plant reproduce in its new home? So there are many southern species of trees and shrubs that people bring north and they survive, but their seedlings sometimes do not harden off properly in the fall, and they're killed back to the ground and never turn into mature plants. So they are not functional as a self-reproducing species, even though the plants that were brought here are fine. Their progeny do not survive. So you have a lot of different factors here. So I think the jury is out. But remember, the plants also have tremendous, most plants have pretty tremendous flexibility within their gene pools and are able to evolve and adapt to changing conditions. So we have plants that bloom early, middle, and late compared to the average of that species. So if the cycles are changing or things like that, then maybe the ones that are able to bloom later or earlier will prevail. So there, again, that's the whole reason for maintaining as much genetic diversity as possible so these plants can adapt to the changing conditions.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that question. Pretty interesting stuff there. Let's go next to Paula, and she is in Little Suamico. Hi, Paula.
Good morning to both of you. I have a question regarding miscanthus grass. I'm very big on doing natives on our property, but I do like to have certain plants I'll use as a focal point in some of the gardens. And I've been looking at some miscanthus grass, but I'm a little hesitant because I don't know, is this invasive? That's the last thing I want to bring in here. So could you speak on that? Are there cultivars that might work, or should I just go, nope, time for a native?
Well, you want to be super careful with miscanthus for a variety of reasons. There are miscanthus that are extremely invasive, and you'll see some of these growing along the sides of the highways where you see these big patches with these silver seed heads, 5, 6, 7 feet tall in the fall, and that is an invasive miscanthus. There are many different species and many different varieties. Some are completely non-invasive and very well behaved. Some are completely not hardy. In Little Suamico, you're in zone 4, or what used to be zone 4, maybe zone 6 by now. But so there are a lot of miscanthus are not hardy in northeastern Wisconsin. But the biggest danger is that you would bring in some of these invasive ones. In fact, we have not seen this here yet, but not only are there miscanthi that creep by rhizomes to form huge patches, it has become a tremendous pest in the east, in the eastern seaboard, where there are miscanthi that seed, self-sow, and they are big, aggressive grasses, and they're taking over highway roadsides and other places. So it's just another non-native species that was brought here for ornamental purposes and opened up Pandora's box, and now all the evil spirits are out causing all sorts of destruction of our native ecosystem. So as an ecologist and native plant aficionado, I would say, forget about it. Don't be planting the miscanthus, okay? If you plant the miscanthus, Tony's coming over, he's going to whack them. Get rid of them.
All right. Thanks, Paula. We appreciate the call. And I didn't know you did voices, Neil. That's pretty impressive.
Hey, sure. You know, you got a problem. We can take care of it for you. Not a problem. Don't say nothing. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. All right. Well, let's go to Michael in Oconomowoc next. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have about 50 acres that I want to get into native prairie. And from my research, I've seen that it's pretty cost prohibitive. So I'm wondering whether there is any funding available to get native prairie established.
Oh, absolutely. There is a program called the Conservation Reserve Program, and it was just it was one of the few things Congress actually decided to do last year, and they refunded it. So, yes, you can go to your local NRCS office, which it's in your county courthouse. It's usually at the county courthouse, but just Google your county and NRCS office, and then you can get in touch with somebody there, and they have really some really good seed mixes. Now they have Monarch butterfly mixes. They have all sorts of different mixes from which to choose, and they offer cost sharing and some pretty reasonable amount of support to help people do this. So it's become a really wonderful program, and a lot of people have proceeded with that. Fish and Wildlife also has some programs. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have been in touch with NRCS about the CRP program, and there are certain stipulations about it that restrict us from being able to implement it on our farm, just because of the you have to have a certain type of plan established, and we just don't meet those requirements. Are there other opportunities from foundations or anything?
I'm not aware of any with foundations. There may be some out there, but I don't see those in my work. Fish and Wildlife Service also has had some programs, again, for habitat restoration, but they will probably have stipulations also as far as land management, time periods. Usually you have to lock your land up for 10 years in the CRP program, depending on the contract. So they will require you to keep it in that condition for a certain period of time. And there are also mowing restrictions because of bird habitat, et cetera. You can check with Fish and Wildlife and see what they might have. I haven't kept up with that this year to see what they have, but those are mostly government programs. I'm not aware of any foundations that provide funding for that.
Okay, thanks for the call. If you have a question, you can call 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. That's ideas@wpr.org. And we did get a couple of emails. Steve in Mount Pleasant said that he has a lot of buckthorn root. He's not alone. He's trying to get rid of. Do you know of any manuals or tools to use or any tips on popping out buckthorn roots?
Popping out. Well, there is a product called the Weed Wrench. And the company, actually, I think they're out in Seattle. I don't know. Maybe they're closed right now. They're out in Washington State or something. But there is a product called the Weed Wrench. Now, they've been in and out of business, and availability has changed. But if you Google Weed Wrench, a lot of people use this for taking out buckthorn. One of the issues, and other large shrubs. One of the issues with the Weed Wrench is that it's a physical process where it rips it literally out of the ground. And anybody who's ripped buckthorn out of the ground, either by hooking up a chain and a tractor and pulling it out or whatever, or a front-end loader, is it is very disruptive to the soil. So if you have any beneficial vegetation there, other trees, shrubs, or wildflowers or grasses or sedges in your woods, they could be collateral damage to this process of ripping out the buckthorn. I have a 20-acre buckthorn farm, which is now down to about 1 acre of buckthorn, and I spent a lot of time getting rid of buckthorn. Now, my land is primarily on a steep hillside, so it was all mano-a-mano, hand-to-hand combat, and it involved chainsaw and loppers cutting down, and in my case, I applied a concentrated glyphosate herbicide to the cut stump in the fall or the winter or the very early spring before the sap starts to move up, and I got 99.99% kill with that without disturbing the soil. And in my case, it's mostly dolomite and rock, so I would be ripping out huge pieces of rock, so manual removal was not an option. There are other options here where people will go in and hire on large scales. They hire a brush cutting machine or a firm that has a brush cutting machine. They actually come in there and just chews everything up. And if you have no beneficial vegetation, then you wait for the buckthorn to resprout the next season and then go in there in late summer and you can spray it with selected herbicides. There are a variety of different herbicides you can use to kill the buckthorn. Of course, this will usually kill everything else depending upon the herbicides that you use. If you use a broadleaf specific herbicide like Garlon, or there are many others. Milestone, I found, is particularly effective. Aminopyrrolid. If you want to kill buckthorn, aminopyrrolid. And it does not kill grasses or sedges. but it will kill flowers, trees, shrubs, etc. Most of them. It doesn't kill. It does not kill garlic mustard. It just bounces right off. Go figure. But it is deadly on buckthorn. So every broadleaf herbicide has certain species that it kills and others that it doesn't. But beware, it will kill most of your beneficial flowers. So there are many, many different ways to do this. But if you want to do it manually, check out the Weed Wrench. Hopefully you can find that and you can go out there and pull buckthorn to your heart's content.
Oh, I tell you, that is quite a job, isn't it, the buckthorn?
It is horrible. But I'll tell you what, once you get it under control, then you just have to go out and pull occasionally.
So that's the key. It's going to be work, but once you get at it, it won't be so bad to keep up, right?
Yep. Once you get it out of there, yes, absolutely.
Now, every time we talk about buckthorn on this show, we have people calling in to ask about goats. Have you any experience with goats coming in and eating the buckthorn?
I have not used goats on buckthorn. I had a project out in the Philadelphia area where they had so many invasive woody plants, it was just a complete destruction. And there was poison ivy and Japanese honeysuckle, and it was just this huge, all junk landscape, acres and acres of it. Mm-hmm. So we fenced off the area and turned goats into it. But one thing very important, if you're using goats, you have to protect every single tree and shrub that you want to preserve with a heavy-duty fence, at least 6 feet high, or they will strip the bark off that tree and kill it. So you have to be prepared for either collateral damage or making sure everything is protected before you turn those goats in there. But they will graze everything right down. They will eat anything. Poison ivy, love it. No problem. So, yes, you can use goats. They won't necessarily kill everything, but they will knock everything back to a point where it becomes more manageable.
More manageable. Okay, great.
Yeah, and then you can take it from there as far as cleaning up the specific survivors.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Neil DeBall. He is the president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. What questions do you have about prairie gardens? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. On Monday at 11, we'll talk with an author about how to choose a doctor for the latter part of your life and how to set up a system to age in place. And then at 11:45, we'll look at palliative care for serious medical problems at any age. That's Monday on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about prairie gardens. And Neil, we did get an email from Andrea to say she wants to create a native pollinator garden at home, but only has a patio for containers. Are natives good for container gardening? And do you have any plants that you would recommend to grow in a warm but mostly shady spot? Ooh, that's tough.
Well, boy, I'll tell you. Growing perennials in containers in our climate is very challenging. So not recommended, because in the ground, you have the insulation of the soil or surrounding the plant roots to protect it. But in a pot, it's elevated above the ground, and so cold can come in from the sides and kill it out. So the temperature in a pot is much, much lower, even closer to ambient temperature than it is in the soil. So when it's 20 below outside, for a few days, it's going to be 20 below in that pot. But in the ground, it may only be 10 or 15 or whatever. So it's not nearly as hard on the roots. So no matter what condition you're in, sun, shade, or whatever, that you would not want to be trying to grow something in a pot outside.
Okay, so not at all. No,
I wouldn't recommend it.
Okay. All right, well, let's go right to the phones then. We've got Dave in Wilmot who has a question for you. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Neil. Hey, I got a bunch of prairie trillium. I've had it about 12, 15 years, and it's kind of clumping up, so I want to divide it. And also kind of some spots where I have it, it's wet. Like right now, the rhizomes are underwater. What would the best time of year be to divide those trillium?
The best time of year to divide trilliums, and this would apply to all species, is in the fall, late summer, fall, after they go dormant. And if you treat trilliums when they're dormant, you cannot kill them. They are bulletproof. So wait till the leaves go turn brown, and then dig them up, and you divide them in the prairie trillium. You will find that you will generate many, many prairie trilliums by dividing them. They're really easy to divide, and they're very prolific.
And they're very pretty, aren't they?
They're beautiful. Mm-hmm. They have a reddish flower. You know, most people think of trilliums as having white flowers.
Right.
Of course, we have trilliums with red flowers, yellow flowers,
there's quite a bit of variety, and the prairie trillium has a reddish flower. Not a big flower. It's a much smaller flower, but it has beautiful, beautiful speckled foliage. So it's just as nice for its foliage, if not more so, as it is for its flower.
Yeah, which is always important since you see that most of the time. Yeah, let's go next to Steve in Yorkville. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. My question is I've got some of that phragmite. What is it, phragmite? Am I pronouncing that right? In my back kind of wetland area.
Yeah,
phragmites. And what is your recommendation to get rid of that? I'm starting to get rid of the water now because there was some standing water, obviously, that's one of the things that they need to grow. What's a good way to eradicate that?
Okay, let me ask you a question. How much area are you dealing with here, Steve?
Probably, I'd say, 10-foot by 10-foot section.
10-foot by 10-foot. Okay. The issue with phragmites is it is a super productive rhizomatous non-native grass, and it has these huge rhizomes up to like a half an inch in diameter, and it's really hard to get rid of it. You can, if you want, you can dig it out or take it out with a bolt with the backhoe. That's the organic method. Other than that, you could potentially smother it for a two-year period where you cut everything back and then cover it with some heavy-duty canvas or something that will really prevent it from coming up. Black plastic doesn't usually work because it has these very sharp rhizomes. It'll poke right up through it, so you need something really heavy-duty. Or you can treat it with herbicide. If you're in a wetland area, you cannot use traditional Roundup glyphosate. You can use a formulation of glyphosate for wetlands called Rodeo, and it has a different surfactant than your standard Roundup or other standard glyphosate herbicides, and it's the surfactant that causes problems to amphibians, fish, etc. So you have to make sure you use a Rodeo formulation if you're going to spray it with herbicides. So if you don't want to spray it, if you're not going to spray, here's a way you can actually reduce the impact of the herbicide, is that you go out there and bundle it. When it's tall, you can bundle a bunch of the stems together with the leaves and then go out there with the glove of death, where you put rubber herbicide gloves on and then put a cotton glove over one and then spray the herbicide from a sprayer bottle into the glove, the cotton glove, and then just stroke the plant, the bundled stems and leaves with that. And that way you're not introducing any spray onto the water or soil surface. It's only on the leaves of the plant.
Okay.
But that's a much more laborious method than just going out there and spraying it with a sprayer. But make sure you use Rodeo no matter what if you're in a wetland situation.
Thank you for the call, Steve. Next, we'll go to Jill in Racine. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'm having moved. I get to start a new garden. If I name three plants, could you just sort of make a general comment on the three that I've chosen? White prairie clover, sky blue aster, and meadow blazing star.
Are you trying to do a red, white, and blue garden?
Oh, not really. I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah. Your white prairie clover, the sky.
Because they'll attract.
What is your soil type?
Well, I thought all Wisconsin was pretty acidic.
Well, no, actually. Most of southern Wisconsin is alkaline, but not exclusively. But you also have other factors in soil, and particularly soil texture, which are things like sand, loam, clay, silt loam, clay loam, silty clay loam, et cetera, which will determine your drainage, your water holding capacity, your fertility, et cetera. So the first and foremost factor in determining what plants will grow somewhere is understanding the soil and the soil texture. Then how much organic matter? Is it bereft of organic matter? Do you have like a super dry sandy soil like a sand dune? That's a very tough growing environment, but there are some prairie plants that will grow there. Like sky blue aster will grow in very dry sandy soils. White prairie clover needs an alkaline soil. Most, but not all of your legumes, purple prairie clover and white prairie clover, need a neutral or alkaline soil in order to do well. They won't do well in acid soils. But then you have other legumes like lupine or round-headed bush clover that do fine in acid soils down to pH of 5. So you want to make sure you know what your soil texture is, your organic matter content, your pH, and then your nutrient status. Then you can start to select the plant. So that's the first thing to do. But if you're in Racine, you said?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you probably have a loamy or silt loamy soil. Could be heavy clay, depending how close you are to the lake. The area is close to the lake.
Well, we're pretty close. And two unfortunate pines were taken down. And I wound up with pretty nice soil.
Okay, so it's a nice, rich black soil?
Oh, it is.
Okay. Then you should be able, is it well-drained?
Absolutely.
Okay, then you should be fine with those plants. That's what we call a medium or mesic soil. So it's a good, rich soil that's well-drained. It's not damp. It's not dry. Then any plant that will grow in a medium or mesic soil, in the sun conditions that you have, I'm assuming it's full sun, then those are the plants that you can select. So all three of those plants will grow, would be expected to do well in that situation, assuming that your pH is 7.0 or above for the white prairie clover.
Well, a friend of mine has been to your nursery, and she said, go there.
Well, actually, we are a mail order internet only nursery now. We did have a retail store for many years, but we closed it in 2016 because we are literally in the middle of nowhere and we're not exactly what you would call a destination. So it really wasn't working out. So we went back to our roots as a mail order nursery. So unfortunately, we don't have any retail facilities here.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Jill. And Neil, why don't you just talk a little bit about maybe some of the new things you've got to offer this year at Prairie Nursery?
Well, we keep expanding our line of shrubs and flowers. We don't have a whole lot of new grasses or anything, but sedges have been an area of great interest, and many of your sedges will grow in shady places, and the shady garden has been oftentimes downplayed or ignored.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important that people look at the options for growing native plants, not just trees and shrubs in the shade, but not just flowers, but also some of the sedges, which are also very beautiful and low maintenance. So, but if people say, Neil, what have you got that are new plants to offer? And I say, well, most of our plants are, you know, from the early Pleistocene.
So
it's not like we have anything really new.
Do they still buy from you when you say that?
Yes, they do. Again, that all comes back to the whole concept of preserving diversity, genetic diversity, rather than having the latest new selection. So, and, you know, from a business standpoint, I looked at it and thought, geez, you know, we won't really have anything really new because we don't have this new variety or that new variety. But what we're finding is that people really are committed to the concept of making sure they have open pollinated plants that can hopefully adapt to changes in our climate and provide high quality ecological services for pollinators and other critters. So
right.
It's been very, very rewarding to see that people are really taking that to heart and gardening with open pollinated species.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to the phone. We have Kel in Sugar Camp. Hi, Kel.
Hi. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering how big a patch I would have to grow of native lupins to keep a population of Karner blues. The last time I saw Karner blue was like 9 years ago. I'm north of Rhinelander.
Okay, yeah. And so you saw them at Sugar Camp? They were actually present?
Yeah, I saw some. Yeah, I saw them one summer. Yeah.
Okay. You know, I'm not an entomologist, so I can't really speak to how big a patch you need. One of the things about the Karner blue butterfly is that it is believed that its flight is not very distant, so they only will move a few miles from wherever their population center is. Although, I don't know if that's actually true, that's what they say, but we get, any time we plant lupin here, we get the Karner blues automatically, and supposedly there were not known Karner blue populations here before we planted it, but who knows where they are? Not everybody knows where each population is. So I don't really know the ultimate size, but I can say this, the more the better. But the other thing is, you can't just plant lupin and expect the butterflies to do well. You got to make sure that they have nectar plants. Now, as many of our listeners know, the wild lupin, Lupinus perennis, is the host plant for the caterpillar of the federally endangered Karner blue butterfly. And Wisconsin, central Wisconsin primarily, is the stronghold of this butterfly, which used to occur in western New York State, Michigan. And there are still some populations in the UP. But it's become increasingly rare in the country. So there are, I believe, and the entomologist can correct me, I think there are 3 flights of the Karner blue every year, 3 generations. And they do need, the adults do need nectar in order to prosper, breed, and lay eggs. So you want to make sure, if you're planting habitat for Karner blue, make sure and use a real nice, diverse prairie mix that contains some of their favorite nectar plants, which includes the blazing stars and dotted mint, butterfly weed. There are a lot of different plants that grow in the dry sandy soils where the lupine grows. And of course, in order to grow the native lupine, you can only grow that in very dry sandy soil. If you plant it on good soil, forget about it. You're throwing your money away. Maybe just throw your dollars on the ground and burn them. Forget about it.
I've had experience with that.
Yeah.
My soil was way too good. We've got a very short minute here before we're going to take a break, Neil. But do you have help for someone who wants to get rid of wild strawberries in a perennial garden? Chris in Crystal Lake in Illinois asked.
Wow, getting rid of wild strawberries. Well, wild strawberries creep by rhizomes, and many rhizomatous perennials are very difficult to get rid of. I honestly have never attempted to get rid of a batch of wild strawberries, so I really can't tell you. But based upon the ecology of creeping rhizomatous perennials, it's going to be a battle, and you're going to have to dig out as many as possible, hopefully get them all. If that doesn't work, then sometimes you can dig out the desired perennials and dig up the whole bed and then put the perennials back in after you have taken out all of the strawberries. But
okay.
That's quite a task. That's a big task.
Yes, it is. We've been talking with Neil DeBall. He is the president of Prairie Nursery and a consulting ecologist. This is Garden Talk. Stay with us. Lots more to come on the Ideas Network. Oh, thank you to Lisa Johnson, one of our regulars, for that, letting us use that beautiful music. We're talking about prairie gardening on Garden Talk today. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller, and it's always great to have Neil DeBall back with us. He's the president of Prairie Nursery. What questions do you have about prairie gardening? Are you looking for plant recommendations? Or maybe what problems are you having trying to establish your prairie? Join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Neil, one of the things that we did want to talk about before we go back to the phones is burning of prairies, because this is the time when we have a lot of that, isn't it?
Yes, spring is when most people burn prairies, although some people will burn in the fall. And why do we burn prairies? It's not just because it's a whole lot of fun and we get to drink beer afterwards or wine first.
And of course not.
Always make sure you burn first, beer
late.
Second.
Oh, good advice. Order. That's why you're the expert, Neil.
I did that once. It didn't work out real well. So. But it was on a very small scale. At any rate, but the reason that we burn prairies usually is, number one, to remove all the dead vegetation that obstructs the new growth. And this helps the prairie wake up earlier when we do a spring burn by exposing the soil to the warming rays of the sun. So that's first and foremost, because the dead vegetation that has accumulated in the last year or two or three since you last burned it or mowed it or whatever will block the sun. And most of your prairie plants are warm season plants, meaning they need warm growing conditions and warm soil conditions in order to initiate growth and really fully develop. So by burning off all the dead material, we expose the soil, sun shines on it, temperature goes up, and the prairie makes up faster. However, there are other reasons to burn, and that is to control cool season weeds, grasses, and in cases of trees and shrubs, to keep trees and shrubs from invading and turning your prairie into a forest, which it will if you do not burn, mow, or graze the prairie. You have to keep the trees and shrubs up, because where we live, where you get 30 to 35 inches of rain a year, it's going to favor woody vegetation over herbaceous grasses and flowers. So how do we do that? Well, if you want to get maximum control of cool season weeds like quackgrass, smooth brome grass, white clover, red clover, the list goes on, but basically you're trying to control cool season non-native perennials that begin growth 4 to 6 weeks earlier than your warm season prairie flowers and grasses, and they get the jump on the prairie plants. They're starting to lock up the moisture and the nutrients in the soil, the foliar zone. They're growing well in advance of many of our prairie plants. So what we do is we use their advantage against them. So after those plants, the target plants, the cool season grasses, the clovers, et cetera, have initiated growth and have grown usually 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 inches tall, we burn them. Now, what does that do? Well, most of your prairie plants are still dormant under the soil because they have not experienced warm enough temperatures to emerge. So when we burn, when the target plants are already greened up, we not only deny them of their new growth, which required root reserves, basically their bank account has been drawn upon to make that new root reserves, but they haven't had a sufficient time of photosynthetic activity to replenish those roots. So they're already at a disadvantage after the burn. And we turn the soil black, and when the sun hits the black soil, temperature of the soil rises drastically, and the prairie plants have an advantage. The warm season prairie plants now have an innate advantage over the cool season plants, which were doing just fine with all that dead material shading the soil and keeping it cool. So that's the main reason why we burn in the spring. Now,
go ahead.
Just one other aspect here.
Sure.
You have to be careful. If you do this repeatedly, especially every year, we do not recommend burning your prairie every year, especially in mid-spring or late spring, to control cool season weeds, because it will tend to push your prairie away from the prairie flowers and more towards the grasses. The equilibrium will shift. And so people that burn every year wonder why their flowers all went away. Well, it's because you burned them at the wrong time, and most of the prairie grasses really benefit from a late spring burn. So what a lot of people will do is they will alternate a spring burn maybe with a fall burn every other year. And with a fall burn, that's a fairly neutral burn because it doesn't really favor anything in particular, but it does at least help the plants to green up earlier the following spring because there's no vegetation interfering with the sun warming up the soil. Okay. So it depends on what your goals are. If you have a dry prairie with lots of early blooming flowers like violets and prairie smokes and cocoons, you don't want to burn in the spring. You want to burn in the fall because those plants will be dormant and unharmed by burning in the fall after usually in October or November. So the burning and the frequency every 2, maybe 3 years. What I have found is if you have problems with invasion by buckthorn, honeysuckle, my problem in my house, black walnuts, believe it or not.
Yeah, I can relate.
They are my worst. Oh, my God. If I burn every other year in mid-late April, usually late April where I am in central Wisconsin, I can essentially keep woody plants out of my prairie. But if I go 3 years between burns, the woody plants that have become established now have sufficient root systems that they will survive that burn, and then I have to go in and then usually cut them to the ground and apply some just a few drops of herbicide to them to kill them, to keep them out.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't, if I burn every other year, I can keep them out almost without any chemicals.
Yes, we had a listener that sent a message to say that the only thing that he can grow under black walnuts are squirrels.
Yes, and the squirrels are adept at planting those black walnuts
in my
prairie. So I'm going to become a squirrel hunter.
Exactly. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones. We've had Debbie and Milton waiting for a while. Thank you so much, Debbie. What can we help you with?
Hi there, Neil and Jill. Say, I cringed when you mentioned Canada Wild Rye to the gentleman that wanted something to plant along his riverbed. And I know that there's a good reason why that's included in a lot of seed mixes. In fact, people who want to plant prairies, it's going to be in those mixes unless they stand on their head and insist that it be taken out. But Canada Wild Rye can be very injurious to dogs. So yeah. If anybody who is planting something and they plan to have dogs running through it, even if it's their family pet, they really do not want to have that in the mix. Canada Wild Rye has a barbed seed on it. And when the dog is running through the field, it inhales that seed and it migrates through the body like a fish hook. And I've been working with Pheasants Forever for about the last 10 years to try and get it out of their mixes.
Yes, that's a very good point. And not just Canada Wild Rye, but there's also another species called Virginia Wild Rye, which is used in wetland mixes and in woodland mixes. So these are both barbed species. So you would want to be careful if you have dogs not to, to plant these.
So a good idea, and for anyone who wants to plant native or any plants, is just to do some research, isn't it, Neil?
Absolutely. And the more educated you are about what you're planting and what you're doing, the better results you'll have, and the better we'll match your goals for your landscape.
Sure. Okay, up next, Bob in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Bob. What's going on?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm a stormwater engineer, and I've used Neil's products for quite a few projects. His no-mow grass is wonderful, but a neighbor of mine and I, we back up to a park at the municipality only mows once a year, and we've been installing some native plants, big blue, little blue compass plants. There's all kinds of milkweed back there that does great, and I'm just looking for ideas or for some flowers to help provide nectar throughout the year. And in the fall, I'm pretty well covered with the milkweed, but earlier in the year, full sun, good soil, or it's got a lot of nutrients in it.
Okay, so you're looking to add some flowers to this bulb, is that correct?
Yeah, you know, get a little more varieties, provide nectar throughout the summer season, maybe spring.
Okay, and this is an established prairie that was seeded, or a native prairie that's been established?
No, it is a village park, but they only mow it in late fall to control woody vegetation. So they only mow it once a year.
Okay. Well, that's fairly normal as far as the prairie management. You don't want to generally mow the prairie. Most of the time you wouldn't mow it during the growing season because that would be injurious to the prairie plants. Sometimes people will mow in August if you have a woody plant invasion. By mowing in August, that's the time when you can do more damage to the woody plants than mowing it in the fall or the spring because the plants are actively growing. And some people believe, and it would make perfect sense to me, that if you really want to whack those woody plants is you wait to mow them until there is a full moon, because supposedly the energy of the plant is coming up out of the roots into the upper part of the plant during a full moon. And you know the moon rules so many aspects of our life. So maybe there's something to that. So a lot of people will mow in August to mow woody vegetation in August during a full moon. So
wow, interesting.
And here's a really interesting thing. When we were in Sri Lanka in January, every full moon is called Puja Day. And every full moon, kids get off from school. How is that?
Oh,
for a good
my
deal?
Goodness.
Yes. So
I can understand why.
Every Puja Day, full moon day, kids get off from school. And I think that's because the teachers don't want all that acting out behavior on that specific day. But anyway, to answer Bob's question, one of the issues, if you're trying to enhance an established prairie where you have a prairie sod that's been developed over many years, is that there's a very little open soil for you to get good germination and growth of new seeds that you might add. So it's a very inefficient process and can be very expensive in terms of what you get in return for the money you spent. So generally speaking, overseeding an established prairie that's more than two, maybe 3 years old is going to be you're going to get very low rate of germination and recruitment. So what some people will do is if you can burn it to expose the soil, then it will go through with a disc or a harrow or something to lightly work the ground up, just the top inch or two, so you don't destroy the plants that are there, but enough to rip up the root systems a little bit and expose some soil before you overseed. And the best time for overseeding a prairie with flowers is in the fall, because at that time, usually the soil is drier and it's easier to work with. You can burn it off in October, work the ground up and put the seed down. And most of your prairie wildflowers require exposure to cold, damp conditions in the soil to break seed dormancy or to enhance seed dormancy. So you'll get much higher germination the following spring. But if you just go out there and throw a bunch of seed on the ground and hope for the best, you're not going to get much return on your investment. So it really behooves you to either mow everything off or burn it off and then rip the ground up the top inch or two and then put your flower seeds down in the fall.
And did you have any recommendations for which types?
That's a really good question. When you're overseeding into an established prairie, you want to use deep taproot species that can compete with the grasses that are there. So there are, and it depends on your soil type as far as which ones those would be, but there are a lot of legumes that do that, like the lead plant, which is particularly good for dry sandy soil. And then there's white false indigo and cream false indigo. These are also native legumes with very deep tap roots. Purple prairie clover, white prairie clover, round-headed bush clover. If you're on a really sandy soil, the lupine. And there are other taprooted plants that are non-leguminous, such as the butterfly weed, a beautiful orange flower, but it generally does best on dry, sandy soils. And you've got a pale purple coneflower. This is a really good one because it's often able to self-sow and maintain itself because of that deep taproot. That's an echinacea. It's closely related to purple coneflower, but pale purple coneflower. Some people have good results with rattlesnake master, which also has deep roots, which seems to require an alkaline soil, just like the purple prairie and white prairie clover, pH of 7.0 or higher. It'll grow in pH 8 or higher. Some other examples of deep trap-rooted plants would be the compass plant and the prairie dock. This is in the Silphium genus, and these are very deep-rooted plants, and they can be established in an established sod if you can work up the ground a little bit beforehand. And then Ohio spiderwort also has a deep root. So those are some examples of what you can overseed with, usually successfully, with proper site preparation prior to seeding.
Okay, thank you very much for that call, Bob. Let's go now to Paul in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, or good afternoon now.
Yes, it is.
The question I have is, I'm in a subdivision here in Illinois, and we basically it's 1 acre lots, and between me and my neighbor there's a drainage ditch, that was put in during when the subdivision was formed about 35 or 40 years ago. And over the years, woody stem plants, grasses, and grass clippings have, you know, grown and or met at that whole area. So now the ditch is, instead of being like 20 feet wide, is like 40 feet wide. And when we get a heavy downpour, you know, the water flows through there pretty fast because there's a retainage pond where it empties into. But if there's not a heavy rainfall, you know, gravity has lost its power, and there's a bunch of standing water that has got everything under the sun growing in it. And my neighbor and I had a county agent come out, and we talked about regrading, and he said, well, you could get in more trouble with the regrading with wetlands and everything else that he was talking about. And his solution was to do new planting, rip out everything that's there and put in new plantings to try to, you know, make that ditch a little narrower. And so that being the condition, I was just wondering if there's some sort of a prairie garden would could go in there, and if so, what would the plantings be?
Well, first and foremost, if I understand this correctly, the beginning of the problem was the invasion by the woody plants that caused this issue. Is that correct? Have I got that right?
Yeah, it's probably, you know, 30% woody plants and 70% different kinds of tall grasses.
Okay, and so the problem is, what exactly is the problem you're trying to solve here? Maybe I misunderstood that or didn't get that.
We're just trying to make the ditch, instead of being 40 feet wide with standing water, you know, try to reduce that down to, say, the original size of about 20 feet.
Okay, and this 20 feet would...
When it does rain really hard, you know, the water comes rushing over our properties, and although it's grass, we both think, you know, we've both experienced some kind of erosion. And so we're trying to, you know, stop the erosion of our property, you know, washing out to God knows where.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it's very difficult to give you advice on a complex situation like this remotely without seeing it. So I would be a little bit hesitant to try and give you an idea. But I can tell you this, that to control erosion, if you can establish dense prairie grasses and possibly some flowers with it, and maintain them with mowing or burning to prevent invasion of woody plants, that's going to give you the best long-term control. And you're right, you will have to kill everything off or bulldoze it or whatever, resculpt it, and then reseed it in order to do that. But stick with the prairie grasses, and I would add some flowers if you want some color and ecological services for pollinators, but make sure that you mow it annually or burn it every other year to keep woody plants out from that situation.
Yeah, and then, you know, it obviously the depth of the water at the edges is less, but when you get like to the center, it could be, you know, 12 to 15 inches deep.
That's a whole different situation. Now you're into aquatic plants, and so you've got the sides of the slope which would be more well drained, and you could use prairie flowers and grasses. But when you get into an aquatic situation, you're looking at a completely different set of suite of different plants, and this is where you really, you're getting into some details here that would be very difficult for me to address over the phone, unfortunately.
So get some professional help on that one.
I would get professional help. Many of us could use that, benefit that, starting with myself.
So. Thank you, Paul, and good luck with that ditch of yours. Let's go next to John in Menominee. Hi, John.
John, hi, thank you for taking my call. So my situation is I have an area of pines. I have about 15 acres of pines, and I have a corridor that runs north and south where the power lines come into my property. And it's probably about 50 or 60 feet wide, and I've always thought that it would be a nice, maybe I'd like to see some pollinating plants or, you know, some flowers and things like that. Am I kind of going to run into real problems with those pines, or is that and the orientation of being north and south, or what, you know, what should I do about that?
Okay, so the right-of-way is 60 feet wide, you said?
It's about that, yep.
Okay, and it runs north-south, so you have morning shade and afternoon shade, but you get direct sun probably between 10 o'clock in the morning to 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Is that correct?
Depending, I would say so, yeah.
Okay, well, that's enough to grow prairie flowers and grasses, but beware that the right-of-way and the power company probably reserves the right to use broadleaf herbicides to control woody shrubs and trees. And if you're looking at pollinator plants, you're looking at wildflowers that will be killed by those same herbicides that they use for controlling trees and shrubs. So you would want to check with the power line company to find out how they manage it. If they just manage it with mowing, when do they mow? Are they mowing in the middle of the summer when your flowers would be blooming, so you get limited use of the pollinator plants? Will they be using herbicides that could kill all your flowers? So you want to find out what their management protocols are and then determine if this is really something you can effectively do.
Okay, thank you, John, for that call. Joe in River Falls is trying to convert a 20 by 75 foot area to wet messick prairie. He plans to do a spring burn and then smother the area with cardboard. So one of his questions is, would he be able to plant a native seed mix by fall of 2020, or should he wait until 2021? And secondly, what is a good way to control reed canary grass from creeping back in? You have 3 minutes. Go.
Okay, here we go. The protocol for controlling the existing vegetation will depend upon the species that you're fighting.
Okay.
If you are up against reed canary grass, that is one tough dude, and I would go for the 2 years for sure. Okay, so smother for 2 years, mm-hmm. and that will take it out. Most perennial weeds, if you smother for 1 year, you can kill them. Most grasses, almost for sure, reed canary grass and Phragmites are two potential exceptions. Now, there are some broadleaf weeds that require smothering for 3 years, things like Canada thistle, field bindweed, and crown vetch. These are not only difficult to smother because they have amazing root systems, they also are resistant to glyphosate or Roundup. So even if you go to spray them, you have to use a specific broadleaf herbicide designed to take those guys out. Then, as far as the he said, what was the other question? I'm sorry.
When should he plant with the native mix? Should it be fall of this year or next year?
Okay, how much time do I have?
You've got 45 seconds.
Okay. I'll give you a quick rundown here.
Okay.
Planting in the fall favors the wildflowers because they are exposed to the cold, damp conditions that helps them break dormancy in their seeds, so they get much higher germination the following spring with a fall dormant seeding. However, the warm season grasses like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, side oats grama, show much depressed germination the following spring with a fall dormant seeding. Something happens to that seed in the soil over the winter, reducing their germination. If your goal is primarily grasses, then you would want to plant in May or June. But there are many, many of the wildflowers, the prairie wildflowers, that do just fine with the planting in May or June. So if grasses are your goal, plant May or June. If flowers are your main goal, plant in the fall. A middle ground is to do a frost seeding, usually February or early March, when the ground is frost heating, and the seeds will work their way down into a prepared seed bed, and you'll get good germination on both the grasses and the flowers.
Oh, good job, Neil. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Jill. Thank you so much.
You bet. We've been talking with Neil DeBall. He's the president of Prairie Nursery, and he's a consulting ecologist. Hope you can join us on Monday at 11. We talk with an author about how to choose a doctor for the latter part of your life and how to set up a system to age in place. And then at 11:45, we take a look at palliative care for serious medical problems as we age. I'm Jill Nadeau for the Larry Mueller Show. Stay well.